You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Toku Ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host Jess. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producers Caden and Nicholas. Whai Akine coming up on the show, Hannah speaks to Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp about their petition to remove the British monarchy as our head of state, and former Labour MP Mika Whaitere joining Te Pāti Māori. I chat to Axe Karen Chaw about Kiwi Rail track infrastructure problems, the Ute tax, and Axe's stance on calls for Aotearoa to become a republic, and vaccinologist at the University of Auckland, Helen Pitosis-Harris, about their concerns Aotearoa could have a measles outbreak. Caden, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Inside Out's Afi Marshall and Waihapato Matarau's John Fennities on the Disinformation Project's latest report on transphobia in Aotearoa.
Nicholas, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Lewis Holden from the New Zealand Republic campaign about reasons why they believe that we should become a republic. And I also spoke to Graham Edgler, an expert in constitutional law, about the legal implications and processes involved in us becoming a republic.
He aha o whakaaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pā tuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wire mai rane, give us a call in the studio on 309 3879. Ka oa e wāriwāri e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero, anohi pakiheri roki roki mā runga i te pai tuku tuku o irirangi pōho. Me haere ki 95BFM, ira kati.com. Catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly chat with Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp.
For their weekly catch-up, Hannah spoke to Te Pāti Māori's Takutai Kemp about their petition to remove the British monarchy as our head of state, which was launched following the King's coronation. They also discussed former Labour MP Mika Whaitere joining Te Pāti Māori. Here is that interview.
Well, I guess just to start with, firstly acknowledging Heather, you know, being courageous and being brave and providing the key to unlock the shackles, as she says, to setting her whanaunga Mika free. And I just want to acknowledge Heather, you know, for taking that step and being brave to do that. And, you know, it takes a lot of courage to do that, to do what Heather did. And a big mihi to her for being able to unlock those shackles for her whanaunga. But I guess I know everyone's really, not confused, but, you know, just want to know around what happened. And, I mean, for us, it, from where I sit in my role in this, it's that Mika spoke to that, to those that matter, and for her, that's her whānau, her hapū and her iwi, and she listened to her puku, to her wairua, which called her home. And she made a decision to come to Te Pāti Māori. And people are saying it's waka jumping, but for us, we call it, it's about whakapapa affirmation, you know, affirming your right to being who we are as Māori. And she took that step. So it was a great, a really momentous day for us last week on, I want to say Tuesday, last week, Wednesday. Gosh, I've lost the days, but last week was a very momentous day for us as Māori, as Te Pāti Māori. You know, we're 100% sad, but 100% excited about what lies ahead for us, for Te Pāti Māori. And we welcome Mika into Te Pāti Māori, because Te Pāti Māori is the waharoa for anyone who wants to come home, who wants to come back to being Māori, and to be, I guess we say, to be liberated in knowing where the right place is for them to come and be truly Māori.
What do you make of Waititi's statement that Te Tiriti guarantees Māori unfettered control of natural resources, including water, and that Labour's stepping back from that by dropping co-governance? Because that seems to be the reason that she's provided for why she resigned.
Oh, look, Mika has her reasons why and why she has stepped down and come to Te Pāti Māori. And look, we support and tautoko her coming home to an Indigenous party. And we look forward to being with her and being able to see her in an Indigenous space of Te Pāti Māori.
Do you see some echoes of Foreshore and Seabed in terms of there being like a split from Labour over them not providing adequate protection to rights that Māori have?
I mean, they are similar, but also not the same. You know, when we think about, Whaiatari and her crossing the floor and Mika crossing over to Te Pāti Māori, very momentous occasions, but have very two different reasons of why they've stepped across. But for Mika, she's clear about what she wants to do and why she's coming back to Te Pāti Māori. And as the Waharoa, we will always be here for anyone who wants to come home.
What would you say is the difference between Te Pāti Māori and Labour? What differentiates these two political parties?
Well, we are the only Indigenous political party in Aotearoa. We strive for mana motuhake, and tino rangatiratanga is the vehicle for that. So, and we are very clear that we haven't ceded any of our rights, and so there's a big difference between Te Pāti Māori and Labour. But the main thing is we can be truly Māori and true to who we are.
And I guess there's more space to sort of push that forward as a coalition partner than there is within the party itself, is there?
Well, we can be unapologetic. We can speak our truth. And it's done in a mana-enhancing way. And it's always about mana motuhake. And it's always about our people.
Just moving on to the coronation of King Charles that just happened over the weekend, I understand that Te Pāti Māori was calling for the King to acknowledge and apologise for the impacts of colonisation. Now, obviously, this didn't happen at the coronation, but it's still worth getting into. Like, what does merit an apology from the Crown?
Well, like Kirawiri has said, there is no honour in this Crown. It's tainted with the blood of Indigenous nations, and the throne upon which he now sits is at the apex of white supremacy globally. We, you know, what we want for Te Pāti Māori is that we want, is not actually a republic. What we want is a treaty-centric Aotearoa. And what does that look like? It looks like how we will treat you when you come to our marae. You know, you will be welcomed, you will be fed, no one should be starving, you will be hosted, you will be loved, you will be taken care of, you will be safe. Those are all things that we believe is a tiriti-centric Aotearoa. And, yes, we would love to see an apology from the King and the Crown, but until then, hey, this is what we are striving towards, a tiriti-centric Aotearoa.
You mentioned that the British Crown sort of sits on the blood of Indigenous nations, and Te Pāti Māori's call to the King to acknowledge the impacts of colonisation, that was actually part of a joint statement with other Indigenous peoples in the Commonwealth, wasn't it? It was actually a matter of solidarity between Indigenous peoples who have all been subject to the same treatment by the British Crown.
Yes, correct. So it was an advocacy group of 14 countries, you know, and all asking for the same, for an apology from the Crown, from the King, about the impact of colonisation and their role in that in terms of our Indigenous nations.
What are the actual impacts of colonisation that we're talking about here?
Well, look, we can already see it, you know, and if I just use an example of what happened with King Tuheitia, you know, and over at the coronation, and where our own government didn't acknowledge or respect him as King Tuhaitia, as the Māori king, and did not follow protocol, did not follow tikanga in the way that it should have been upheld for King Tuhaitia. So that's just a simple impact of colonisation, where our own government undervalue who we are as a people and undervalue our Māori king. And for us, it's not acceptable. And I'm not sure if you heard, but Tuku Roirangi Morgan, the chair, has called for Phil Gough's resignation, because we should be, and there should, you know, we've been asked calling for senior advisors, senior roles for Māori to be in these positions so that this, the our tikanga are followed and respected. And we've seen it time and time again. And this is just another example of colonisation, the impact it has, and how our people are treated.
You mentioned that we should move towards a Tiriti-centric Aotearoa. And I was just wondering if this sort of seems to be momentum building in moving away from the crown or cutting ties. For example, Barbados became a republic last year. Does this like fit into this sort of momentum that's building?
Well, what we're saying in Te Pāti Māori is that is not a republic. You know, what we want is not a republic. What we want is a Tiriti-centric Aotearoa. And that looks like how we will treat you when you come to our marae. You know, you will be welcomed, you will be looked after, you'll be fed, you'll be taken care of, you'll be safe.
So does that mean maintaining a relationship with the Crown?
Well, we can always have a relationship. It just depends what that looks like. But what it is a Tiriti-centric Aotearoa.
I guess I'm just wondering if, because Te Tiriti is a document that was signed between Māori and the Crown, does that necessitate maintaining that relationship with the Crown instead of, you know, becoming a republic and cutting that tie entirely?
A Tiriti-centric Aotearoa is based on Te Tiriti or Waitangi. So it's not based on the Treaty of Waitangi, which is what, you know, is upheld at the moment. What we want is it is based on Te Tiriti or Waitangi, and that would be the founding document moving forward.
That was Te Pāti Māori's Takuta Kemp on their calls for the British monarchy to be removed as our head of state, as well as Meka Whaitiri.
That was our weekly chat with Te Pāti Māori's Takuta Kemp.
Classic journal question as well. Can I have a jaw?
The Wire.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Karen Chua.
Today I spoke to Karen Chua about ongoing issues with Kiwi Rail track infrastructure, the government's recent announcement that they will be increasing the ute tax, and ACT's stance on calls for Aotearoa to become a republic and remove the British monarchy as our head of state. Here is that interview. The first topic I wanted to talk to you about today would be the train issues that have come up across the country. So here in Auckland, all trains were abruptly cancelled on Friday, and some trains have been cancelled indefinitely due to a Kiwi Rail track infrastructure problem. What do you think about this situation?
Look, I think, you know, Auckland and Wellington commuters have rail which works really well when it runs on time and things are going well. And huge investment has been put into the Auckland network over the past 20 years. But when things go wrong, there doesn't seem to be any accountability, and we're throwing a whole lot of money in, and nobody seems to want to take responsibility for that. And so we really think that, you know, the people operating the trains should be held accountable and have contract performance standards and have their payments docked if the trains are at fault or if the rail's at fault. There has to be some accountability, but that we've put major money into this infrastructure and there should be no excuses as to why this is happening.
Do you believe that Kiwi Rail has been an effective investment?
Well, you know, infrastructure is always used as like a political tool. We tend to spend our infrastructure budget very poorly. We have we're undisciplined. We don't have debt caps, and we don't need to really provide a real return on capital. And I think we really need to have a good look at how we are investing in our infrastructure in the future to make sure that this sort of stuff doesn't happen.
And in Wellington in particular, which has also experienced mass issues with trains, activist groups have been demanding that the government reinstate nationwide passenger rail networks. Do you think this would be beneficial for Aotearoa?
Yeah, look, I think ACT has a policy and an infrastructure policy document. It's really complicated and hard to go through the whole thing at once. Simon, our infrastructure spokesperson, can probably speak to this better. But we really need to re-look at how we are funding these projects and making sure that the money has been spent wisely and that we're forward planning. And so we have a policy where we would take it out of the politicians' hands to be reactionary and just put out policies that may not be we may not be capable of delivering, and actually make sure that local governments actually have a bigger say into what they need in their areas and where the funding should go.
Last week we spoke a bit about encouraging more people to use public transport by making it more affordable and accessible. Is this a priority for ACT, and how would you achieve this?
Yeah, I really think we need to get the current infrastructure that we do have in place working well. In order to get people into public transport, we need to make sure that public transport is reliable. And we've been hearing lots of stories all around the country about how unreliable it's becoming. And it's hard to build that trust back when you have children standing on the side of the road when a school bus doesn't come or doesn't stop for them, when you have people waiting 2 hours at a bus station and a bus just doesn't show up. So I think it's about, we need to make sure that the current infrastructure that we've got in place and the current buses and trains are actually running efficiently, and people will get back on them if they can trust them.
The next topic I wanted to talk to you about was the announcement last week that the ute tax will be increasing. What do you think about this decision?
Oh, look, I just think that this whole policy needs to be scrapped. Making cheap and reliable cars more expensive for people who are just trying to get on with life and feed their families is just quite insulting. It's actually one of the Labor's dumbest policies. You know, the last clean car discount paid out around $80 million to Tesla owners. It didn't actually help our environment whatsoever. Shifting to EVs don't reduce total emissions in this country because they won't use the carbon credits under the ETS, so they're just freeing those credits up for someone else to use. So it's a policy that sounds good, but at the end of the day, it's just paying rich people to have nicer cars, while poorer people who are just trying to get on with life are getting taxed for using a vehicle that they have no other choice but to use.
Deputy Prime Minister Carmel Cipollone has defended this policy, stating that it's just a one-off cost and that some New Zealanders are purchasing these vehicles for not practical reasons. Do you think this is a fair justification for the tax?
Look, who are we in Parliament to tell people to justify why they buy a certain vehicle? I just think this is just getting way too far into our lives, and it's none of government's business why you've purchased a vehicle. And the problem with saying it's just a one-off fee is actually quite hard on those who are down in the Hawke's Bay right now who are having to replace a lot of their vehicles that some may have been quite new that are paying this tax all over again. So there are lots of different issues with this tax, but ACT will repeal the ute tax and the Zero Carbon Act because these just drive bad policy, and they also pick winners, and it's very divisive. It's making people who drive an EV being a good person, and then if you're caught driving a ute or a petrol vehicle, you're a bad person. It's not necessarily true, and we shouldn't be creating this divisive kind of policy.
So then is shifting New Zealanders into cleaner vehicles a priority for ACT? Because by getting rid of some of those acts, it would seem perhaps not.
Well, the thing is that this policy doesn't actually achieve that, because whilst they say it's to reduce emissions, it's not actually reducing emissions. It's just freeing up those credits for someone else to use. So if they really wanted to reduce emissions, they would be looking at different policies. This policy does not reduce our total emissions.
And lastly, I wanted to ask you, after the coronation of the king this weekend, we've seen some calls, in particular from Te Pāti Māori, for Aotearoa to become a republic. The Prime Minister has stated that this isn't a priority right now. What is ACT's stance on New Zealand potentially becoming a republic?
Yeah, I'd have to agree with the Prime Minister. Right now, we have a whole lot of issues in our country that take priority over that conversation. Right now, we have high unattendance at school from our children. We have ram raids happening almost every night. We have people struggling to feed their families, and we're dealing with an inflation problem right now. And so, I mean, I have to agree with our party leader, David, when he said, if you can explain to us how ditching the king will help with any of those issues, then we're all ears. But right now, this is just a distraction, and we need to be concentrating on what's actually affecting New Zealanders right now, and it's the cost of living.
Do you believe we have an obligation under Te Tiriti to become a republic?
Look, like I said, these conversations probably need to be had in the future, but right now it's not the right time to be having this discussion, because we have people that are struggling to feed their families right now, and they want to hear what we're going to do about that. And if we were to have this discussion, it would be something that the whole country would have to have a say on. And maybe that means in the future we may need to have a referendum on this topic, but right now it's just a distraction to what's important to New Zealanders.
Some of the, I guess, justification for this was because people are struggling to feed their families here and in the UK, where there's also a cost of living crisis, that it isn't wise for us to be spending a lot of money on these elaborate events like a coronation. Is this a fair justification, do you think, for us having a discussion about becoming a republic?
No, not really. Not at the moment. I mean, that's something that may be overseas. They might want to have that conversation about the money that was spent on this coronation. But you've also got to look at the positives of what that brought the world together. I mean, how many millions of people were watching that night? And having a think about this particular topic. And it may bring up this discussion, and it may be a good thing. But right now, like I said, we need to be concentrating on what's actually affecting New Zealanders right now. And that is the issues about how we're going to put food on the table next week. So yes, whilst I agree that this discussion may need to be had, I just don't think now's the right time.
That was ACT's Karen Chua on Kiwi Rail, the ute tax, and the debate sounding Aotearoa becoming, actually, sorry, just a correction, that was, it's a debate around Aotearoa becoming a republic, but Te Pāti Māori's petition is specifically to remove the British monarchy as our head of state.
That was our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Karen Chua.
For old time's sake, yes or no, would you like to be leader of the National Party at some point?
No, I'm just focused on what I'm doing. I'm one of those people that do it day by day, job by job.
I'll save this clip and come back to it in 5 or 10 years. We'll see how it's aged.
The Wire.
I love that clip because literally a week later, Chris Luxon was the leader of the National Party. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Hey, Captain, do you think we'll ever find the land of the good groove?
Patience, Sonny Jim.
It's just, we've been floating on this dinghy for months, since the crew mutiny.
Patience, Sonny Jim.
It's concerning that you keep repeating that. I don't even think my name is Sonny Jim. Is that my name? Captain?
Patience, Captain. Sonny Jim. I am Sonny Jim. We are both Sonny Jim.
Lando, we made it. Let's drink some more seawater to celebrate.
Land of the Good Groove with Murray Kamek. Bringing a solid hour of funk, electricity and soul to your Friday afternoons. It's time to get loose. Land of the Good Groove, 1 till 2 p.m. every Friday, right here on 95 BFM.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395. The Disinformation Project released a report last week which confirmed that since Posy Parker's arrival in Aotearoa in late March, there has been an increase in anti-trans hate in far-right circles. The report discovered that anti-trans content quickly became the key talking point in these far-right networks due to a tactic called community bridging, where one set of ideas is bridged into a community that doesn't yet hold those ideas. I spoke to Afi Marshall, Te Aroa Tainui, who is a student and Inside Out Kōrero board member, on her perspective on the report as someone who is trans and takatāpui and has experience in this space. Afi uses she-they pronouns. The Disinformation Project report has essentially found an increase in transphobia and hate speech towards trans people since Posy Parker spoke in Aotearoa. Does this line up with your experiences as someone who is takatāpui?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even walking down the street, I've seen an increase in kind of looks and stares, and even some outbursts of being called slurs on the street, which hasn't been great. It was happening before the Posy Parker protest, but I've certainly noticed the looks and stares and things like that increase afterwards.
And the narrative recently has been that trans women are a threat to cis women, and basically anyone who isn't cis is a danger to society. But Waikato academic Kyle Tan has said trans people are essentially being used as a scapegoat and transphobia is being used to reinforce white supremacy. Does that seem like an accurate description to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whakawahine and tangatira tāne existed long before colonisation came to this country. You know, transness is an inherently anti-white supremacist concept. Ultimately, the people that think that trans people are a threat to cis people, especially cis women's safety, probably just don't know any trans women, because often I find that cis women feel extremely safe around trans women. They feel protected, and they feel content to share spaces with them.
A lot of cis people are also concerned about this report. What are your thoughts on how they can be better allies and push back against the rhetoric that's being proven false?
Yeah, I mean, the number one thing I think for cis people in everyday life is to be aware of what's happening, to be aware that, you know, every time trans people walk out in public, we're not safe. We're not as safe as cis people are. We've constantly got to think about the threat of violence, and even things as simple as using the bathrooms that make us feel the most comfortable can be something that causes a violent outburst for something. So, just being aware that basically our entire public lives is constantly under scrutiny and the kind of emotional baggage that comes with.
Are there any actions cis people can be taking to support? I know there's been like counter protests and that kind of thing. Should cis people be showing up to those?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, being out in public normally is unsafe for trans people. When we have those events where people on the far right and neo-Nazis are showing up, that is incredibly unsafe for trans people. So to have, the Posy Parker protest in Auckland was just incredible. I myself didn't go because I didn't feel safe, but the fact that thousands of cis people showed up to say we don't accept transphobia here, that's exactly what we need to see moving forward.
This whole thing began because Posy Parker was allowed entry into Aotearoa. Do you think this shows that the government needs to step up and show more responsibility in protecting trans people?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we saw Posy Parker's tour in Australia gaining traction, and the violence that ensued at her events, and how neo-Nazis showed up and effectively co-opted that event, and that wasn't decried by her. So, we knew the risk of her coming here. The government knew the risk. I'm part of one of the organisations that took the government to court to try and prevent her coming into the country, and the judge's decision ultimately decided that it wasn't the court's place, but that he heavily sympathised with our opinion and believed that the minister's decision was wrong, but it wasn't his place to appeal it. So the courts know, and it was shown in that judgment that the courts know that people like Posy Parker are a violent threat to society, but it's the government's job to actually take action to prevent this.
Now that Posey Parker has left Aotearoa and the immigration minister can't change anything in hindsight, is there anything else the government can be doing right now to protect trans people?
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen Labor backtrack on hate speech plans for hate speech laws. Right now, the only really hate speech protections we have only protect race, colour of the skin and national ethnic origin. And the bar for prosecution is also very, very high, basically impossibly high. So we need to introduce several more protected characteristics, including trans people, gender, sexuality, religion, all these sorts of things, and lower the bar for prosecution so that people can actually take people to court for hate speech and kind of deal with these situations as they arise.
Is there anything else you'd like people to know about the experiences of actually being takatāpui or trans at the moment?
I mean, first of all, like, I want people to know that I never regret being takatāpui, I never regret being trans. It's a beautiful experience, but it comes with some unique challenges that people that don't experience it can struggle to understand sometimes. So I would say just make sure you're listening to your trans friends, giving them space to be emotional, to feel what they feel about these situations, but most of all, show up and keep them safe.
And finally, so this all comes back to a report which has said since Posey Parker came to Aotearoa, there has been an increase in transphobia and hate speech towards trans people. Do you think this is just our new normal, or do you think we can combat this and we can change people's minds about trans people?
Oh, we can absolutely change minds. I mean, the trend we've seen over the past few decades, if we look to a much bigger scope, has been one of acceptance towards trans people, gender diverse people, queer people in general. It's a very recent spike in hate, and so I think, you know, we can ride this wave and we can take actions to prevent it happening in the future. But yeah, I'm hopeful about the future, and I hope that I can, you know, I can retire in a world where it's safe for trans kids to grow up to be trans adults.
I also spoke to John Fennedy, who is a senior lecturer in counselling, human services and social work at Waipapa Taumātauru, the University of Auckland, on anti-trans discrimination and the role of academics in gathering this data. John uses he/him pronouns, and here is that interview. You were involved in the Identify survey of Rainbow Young People. What were the findings of that report, and do they match the findings of the Disinformation Project's report?
I was the lead investigator in Identify. Identify is the largest national study we have of takatāpui and rainbow young people aged 14 to 26. We heard from over 4,800 rainbow young people in 2021 about their experiences across a whole range of domains, including education, schools, university, community sector, some healthcare settings, and also work and employment and in their home lives. And one of the really one of the key things that came through from that study is that while many and around 2,000 of those young people were not cisgender. So they were either part of the trans community or identified in ways that said that they weren't cisgender. And one of the key things that really emerged from those findings were that despite the fact that many of those young trans people are thriving and flourishing, they are also most often the ones experiencing discrimination and harassment, including in schools, at university, as well as at home and in the community. So our findings are important essentially because they show that even before Posey Parker's visit, trans communities and trans people were often facing higher levels of discrimination and abuse than cisgender members of the rainbow community and takatāpui whānau.
So this kind of matches the findings of the Disinformation Project's report in terms of Well, they found that this discrimination has increased, especially in alt-right circles since Posy Parker's visit. So we've now got two very strong sets of data on this. Why is gathering data at all so important?
One of the key issues for Takatāpu and Rainbow communities is the invisibility of our identities. And when our identities are invisible, it means that we're missing from health statistics, from national statistics, and that means it's impossible for us to really advocate with a lot of strength to get our needs and issues met by the various organisations that are responsible for doing that. And making sure that we've got data like the Disinformation Project Focus, like Identify, like Counting Ourselves, is vital because it's the only tools that we have to date that have been able to kind of demonstrate some of the issues that are operating for our communities. The new census, the most recent census, is really positive because finally we're seeing greater recognition of Rainbow and Takatāpu identities. And these studies, though, they play a role because they provide more nuanced understanding about issues that are relevant to our communities that are difficult to kind of collect in a large-scale national survey like the census.
The discrimination goes way back, but the Disinformation Project report has been so shocking because it's kind of affirmed what trans people know, which is that we're facing heightened levels of transphobia. And what do you think this means for trans people?
I think the Disinformation report means that for many trans people, they are becoming increasingly aware. This is another sort of marker, if you will, in the landscape that reaffirms that this is a community that is under threat, and particularly it's seen as an easy target for members of the kind of far right who want to demonise particular groups. And that makes these findings really important for trans people and communities, and really talks to the importance for people who identify as trans or part of those communities to really seek out support from each other and from cis allies to ensure that you're not kind of coping with any of this stuff on your own. And also, you know, as I've sort of articulated, for many trans people, they are aware that this goes back a long way. What is worrying is that it seems as though things are escalating and evolving further. And I think that means that for many trans people and communities, they're going to be much more mindful about how to protect themselves. Even for cis allies, we are often surprised by the level of kind of vitriol that we face in this space. And so I guess the key kind of takeaway is that we need to ensure that people are safe. And whenever we hear transphobia and it's safe for us to do so, we need to appropriately intervene and address it.
What do you think is the role of academics in supporting trans people?
Academics have particular opportunity to use their time and resources to uplift the mana of communities that are often overlooked, underexplored, and marginalised. And academics play a key role both in their ability to promote research that addresses the needs and aspirations of Takatāpu and trans communities, but also in their direct role supporting trans students in classes, supporting trans students in research projects, and the ability they've got to really grow that community. And of course there are trans supervisors and academics themselves who do this. I speak as a cis queer ally in this space, and I think those are the kind of main areas that I would suggest that the ways that academics have ability, and also of course to continually advocate that our fishery institutions are inclusive and welcoming of trans community.
From a data or academic perspective, is there anything else that you think is important for people to know about the Disinformation Project's report?
The data in the Disinformation Project is really important, and it shows a really concerning evolution in an escalation of transphobia. One of the important things that I keep coming back to is that, unfortunately, this transphobia has been around for a long time. The Counting Ourselves Trans Health survey, the Identify survey, even studies from Youth 2000 going back as far as 2000 show that trans people have faced higher rates of discrimination and abuse than cisgender people.
That was Afi Marshall and John Fennessy on the Disinformation Project's report findings of increasing online transphobia.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
We'll be back after the break. Keep it on the B.
Bruce!
Oh, hey.
Bloody hell, mate.
Hey.
G'day, haven't seen you around for ages. What have you been up to?
Yeah, just been real bogged down thinking about space.
Oh, like planets and black holes and stuff?
Yeah, quasars, asteroids, really all the space stuff.
Oh, yeah, so that's your new job now? Like at the observatory?
Nah, just been thinking about it. It's taken me ages, though. It's big ass.
Okay. Yeah.
Spaced Out. Josh Aoraki from Auckland Stardome Observatory and Planetarium talks everything spacey on Spaced Out. 4:40 every other Tuesday, only on 95 BFM Drive. Here in the twilight.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Hate it or love it, or even if you feel disinterested by it, King Charles III's coronation brought up a fresh wave of questions about our relationship with the United Kingdom. People across Aotearoa have been calling for a change in our head of state for decades. I spoke to Lewis Holden from the New Zealand Republic campaign about reasons why they believe that we should become a republic. Three goals as part of your campaign, Mana Motuhake, Kotahitanga and Mana Pori. Would you just be able to explain a little bit about each of those and how it fits in with the idea of New Zealand becoming a republic?
Absolutely, sure. So fundamentally, our campaign is about those three goals, which we obviously want to achieve with having a New Zealand citizen as our head of state instead of the British monarch.
And you spoke about a New Zealand citizen being head of state. How do you see that being played out in policy and legislation, and how would it come about that New Zealand becomes a republic?
Sure. So in terms of policy and legislation, we have some specific proposals on how the legislation would actually work. The first thing to remember, though, is that we actually basically have a head of state in our Governor General who we already pay, so I think it's about $6 or $7 million a year for, to be sort of the stand-in head of state. So we say, well, that's nonsense. We should actually make that office the actual head of state. So I suppose that's the actual policy change that would come about. You'd have some form of a appointment process. We say that should start off with being by Parliament with a super majority and have a specific requirement that it can't be a sitting MP or a former Prime Minister that becomes the head of state under that scenario. And in terms of how that would actually happen, I mean, obviously Parliament would need to pass that legislation for it to become law, but there needs to be a nationwide debate followed by a referendum on the issue. And we'd like to see a referendum held where everyone gets a choice between the status quo or the alternative.
And what are some of the main reasons that you think that New Zealand should become a republic now, and how do you think that would benefit our society?
Sure. I mean, I think the argument about what time and when we should become a republic really comes down to, are we actually a independent society, not just in terms of no longer being a colony of Britain and being independent in a legal sense, but this is independence in a symbolic sense, in that we would have someone who would be our actual head of state, who's able to represent us overseas to the world, because we don't have that at the moment. The British monarch, specifically the Queen Elizabeth, once said that she couldn't represent New Zealand overseas when we had a trade fair in Spain, I think it was, in the 90s. So we know that we're never going to get that sort of level of representation on the international scene from our head of state. We have to rely on other people to do it for us, if they do it at all. And, the argument that we need to keep the monarchy as a check on our parliament is complete nonsense as well. I mean, we've seen a number of times all around the Commonwealth where that simply has not happened. And you know, the British monarch has simply refused to intervene or even acknowledge where there are constitutional issues. So we think that those things are, you know, obviously good reasons to make change. In terms of the benefits, I mean, the benefit really is symbolic. It is about emphasising to the world that we are, in fact, now an independent country and not holding on to what is a colonial era symbol of having the British monarch as a head of state. But also it's about, you know, a sense of national identity and creating that, you know, kotahitanga, so that unity amongst every citizen of this country for, you know, having our own head of state.
In search of answers about the legal processes and implications of New Zealand becoming a republic, I spoke to Graham Edgler, an expert in constitutional law. So I just wanted to ask about the legal processes should New Zealand become or want to become a republic, what we would have to do legally and what that would involve with our constitution.
Parliament would need to pass a law. That's it.
That's all we need to do to become a republic?
As a matter of constitutional law, Parliament would need to pass a law. Factually, they would probably pass a law and then pass another law which set up a referendum, and then we'd probably have a public vote. I would very much imagine, like when we adopted MMP and when we looked at MMP again in the last electoral system referendum, I would be very, very surprised if it was done in any way other than with a referendum. And so that would probably be the case. Parliament would pass a law which would change a few sort of important statutes, the Constitution Act, repeal a few ones that we don't need, you know, the Act of Succession, which says who, you know, who takes over when the king dies. We probably don't need that law anymore. But it would be a relatively simple law. It could certainly become more complicated, you know, depending on how we did it. You know, we could, at the same time as becoming a republic, we could adopt a written constitution like they have in Australia or Canada. But we would not need to. And we could have a, you know, there are a few different options. But, you know, this is the very simplest one is, you know, sometimes called, you know, you just sort of everywhere where the word, you know, the crown appears, you change that to the state of New Zealand. You know, we wouldn't even need to change the person who actually sort of does the work here from the Governor General. We could just make the Governor General the head of state. Yeah, we possibly would do a different way. We wouldn't have to elect a president, and certainly I don't think we'd have would never adopt a US-style presidential system, but we could have, you know, sort of the type of president, or we could call them something else. We could, as I said, still call them Governor General, with probably approximately the same powers they have now, you know, sort of the almost entirely ceremonial role, but equally we could go a little bit further and do some sort of small or large change in sort of the actual structure of how New Zealand governs at the same time. But, yeah, the very simplest form of republic, Parliament could pass the law tomorrow and we'd be a republic on Wednesday. I assume they won't.
And what would be the implications of that, so to Te Tiriti or Waitangi? What would be the implications on the Crown's existing relationship with Māori, and how could we ensure Māori rights are upheld should we become a republic?
Fundamentally, nothing would change. I mean, there would certainly the symbolism would change, and so that might be the real issue. But the obligations that the government has under the treaty are the obligations that the New Zealand government has, and we call that government the Crown and Right of New Zealand. But if we called that government the New Zealand government instead, it would continue having the same obligations it does now. Literally nothing changed, certainly nothing, you know, sort of from a legal perspective. It would continue exactly the same. The treaty would effectively then be a treaty between iwi and hapu and the New Zealand government, whereas at the moment it's between iwi and hapu and the Crown and Right of New Zealand. And that is all that would be legally changing. We would be changing the name of the Crown to the New Zealand government. It's not the British Crown anymore, it's the New Zealand Crown. And so they are legally distinct things, and they have been that way for several decades now. It's not a you know, the document was signed on behalf of Queen Victoria. It is not a document that, or the legal position now is not the British Crown has nothing to do with the obligations now under the treaty. It is the New Zealand Crown. And those would just stay with the New Zealand government exactly as they are now. Some people sort of like the idea of a treaty because they think it will, you know, well, the treaties with the British government. That is just mistaken. You know, a republic, the treaty obligations stay exactly as they are.
Excellent.
And stay with the New Zealand government, which is where they are now.
That was Lewis Holden and Graham Edgler on New Zealand becoming a republic and the legal processes and implications behind that.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say. The Wire.
A measles case has been confirmed in Aotearoa for the first time since 2019. This comes as childhood immunisation rates are at some of the lowest levels in modern times. I spoke to vaccinologist at the University of Auckland, Helen Petosis-Harris, who says it would take a miracle for Aotearoa to avoid a measles outbreak. I started off our interview asking Petosis-Harris why we should be concerned about measles.
Measles is a disease that spreads very, very quickly when it's got people who are susceptible to it. So it's really, you have to have almost everybody in your community immune so it doesn't spread, and it can be very, very serious. So we had a horrible epidemic of measles in 2018, and it also spread then to Samoa, who saw a lot of deaths, about 83 deaths in young children mainly.
Aotearoa's childhood immunisation rates are at some of the lowest levels ever. Can you tell us about what our vaccination levels currently are and how they compare to previous years as well as overseas?
Well, they are very low for should we say, modern times in New Zealand. So they rose up through the 2000s, and by about 2017 or so, 2018, we actually had quite high rates among our infants. So, and there was little inequity. So, Māori, Pacific, New Zealand, European, all the different ethnicities had very similar rates for a brief time. And then they started to go down. So by the time COVID came, we were getting really concerned. And this is something that's been seen overseas as well. Once COVID hit, things got really bad. So now we find ourselves in a worse situation than we were back in 2018.
Yeah, and thank you for that correction as well of modern times. That is quite an important distinction. There have been some concerns about a potential outbreak happening. Do you think we're able to prevent an outbreak at this current stage?
I think we'd need a miracle, because we've just got, we would have to get vaccines into so many people so fast. I find that really hard to imagine that could be achieved, especially as a lot of these people are going to be harder to reach, and we really need the mountain to go to Muhammad. We really need some of those services to get out to the people themselves directly. So I think that's a tall order, to be honest.
Why should people be getting vaccinated against the measles, and who should be getting vaccinated?
We've got some gaps in some of our adolescent and young adults. There's still some low rates there. So that age group, if they're not sure whether they've had two doses of vaccine, get themselves a dose. It's fine. It's sort of have any increased safety risks if you have an extra dose, if you're unsure. And then the other group that are really concerning are the young ones who have been impacted by these really low vaccine coverage rates. So an infant in an area where there's measles can actually have a vaccine as low as 6 months of age. And certainly we've been routinely offering it from 1 year. So it's important to get at least one dose away, and two doses takes that protection right up to getting close to 100%, about 98% after two doses. Very protective, and that protection should last for life.
And what would your call on the government be after this recent case?
Well, you know, we've had a lot of years to get this sorted out, and that hasn't happened. I understand that there's some really good strategies that they're in the process of implementing, I really hope that they will be successful. But right now, it's not something we can achieve, you know, overnight tomorrow. So it's going to come down to everybody needing to check themselves, check their children, their infants, and try and access those vaccines as soon as possible, particularly in those areas where this infection might be most likely to spread. At the moment, that's in West Auckland area.
And that was Helen Petosis-Harris talking about measles in Aotearoa.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Monday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. E whakarongo ana, thanks for tuning in, and thanks to our producers, Caden and Nicholas.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.